Hi, I'm Misha Ketchell, editor of The Conversation. For democracy to work, people need to be well informed. That's why we work with academic experts to share their research and explain issues in the news. Everything we do is free to republish, but we need your support. Please donate to The Conversation by going to donate.theconversation.com or following the link in the show notes.
Welcome to The Conversation's Politics Podcast. I'm Michelle Grattan. This will be a big year for the climate change agenda, culminating in an international conference in Paris to seek agreement on post-2020 action. The Australian Academy of Science has today released a booklet of questions and answers about the science of climate change. One of the spokesmen promoting the booklet is Council Member Brian Schmidt. He's a Nobel laureate and his specialty is astronomy. Today, however, he's speaking in a much more general capacity as an advocate for scientific evidence being central to the policy-making process. Brian Schmidt, thanks for joining us. Why do you think there's been so much public and political tension around this issue of climate change? Of a whole range of public issues, it's the one that generates this huge emotion.
Well, I think ultimately it comes down because the stakes are high. Our economy right now is one that's based around emitting fossil fuels. It's how, you know, we all have the very good lives that we have today. But the problem, of course, is that it has consequences for the future if we continue that. And so I think people like the status quo, and you know, this is a threat. Having to deal with climate change is a threat to the status quo, and that's where a lot of the angst comes from.
And of course, at an industry level, it's a threat to the fossil fuel industry if renewables gradually get more and more of the market. Do you see a time when fossil fuel will be basically phased out or nearly phased out?
Yes, I think we're going to, if we really want to get to climate change under control, you're really looking at a time where fossil fuel emissions need to be sort of a tenth of what they are right now. That's a huge change. I don't think they're ever going to go away completely because they are so incredibly useful. But I see the fossil fuel companies of today being the energy companies of tomorrow. And as long as if they see that opportunity, then this doesn't have to be a threat to them.
And what sort of time frame are we talking about here?
So if you look at the booklet, we really need to have emissions start dropping pretty substantially, you know, in the time period after 2020. And by the time you get to about 2050, 2060, then we need to be at a level many, many times below what we are currently emitting. So if we want to keep climate change to less than 2 degrees, that's sort of what we need to shoot for.
Now, in the United Kingdom, they've just made a cross-party commitment on climate change. Do you see this ever happening in Australia, or do you think the debate here is so polarised that there's not a chance of that?
No, I actually think there's a good chance of it happening here. Both, you know, all the major parties agree that man-made man is contributing to climate change. And so I think the next step is to get them all to agree in an accord, because if we don't do it, it's such a long-term problem. Our country will suffer and our economy will suffer because we'll be unwilling or unable to deal with a global accord when it happens.
When you meet people who are skeptical about the science of climate change, what do you say to them?
So it depends completely who they are. If they're actually a scientific expert in the thing, then I'm going to listen to them. Now, there aren't very many people who I consider scientific experts who are genuinely skeptical of climate change. But the whole point of science is to hear people who are experts out and let them engage in the scientific debate. And that should not change. If it's someone who is less expert, then I like to go through more about the philosophy of science, about how science goes, and why shouldn't the average person believe the panel of experts rather than the individuals. I'm also always interested to hear their point of view, and normally I have enough knowledge myself as a non-expert to, I think, diffuse some of their misconceptions, depending on exactly what they are. So it's always meant to be a conversation. I don't think shouting them and telling them that they're a bad person is the right way to go. I think it's trying to lower the level of confusion.
Some scientists say that the scientific debate about this issue is over, that the science is settled. Is that your view?
I wouldn't say the science is settled. I would say that the question of whether or not humanity is, you know, causing the climate to warm or the climate to change, it's 99, we're sort of 99% sure. Now, 99% sounds, you know, pretty certain, but to a scientist, we want to do better. The continual forecast warming of the Earth will make it a lot easier to be more certain in the future. So that will, I think, probably will not be an issue in another 10 or 15 years at all by anyone's account. But no, the science is not completely settled. We do need to understand more. It's an evolving process where the better we understand the climate, the easier and more efficiently we'll be able to deal with the changes we've caused and how we're going to mitigate those causes in the, or those changes in the future.
Let's talk for a minute about those scientists who are outliers on this issue, experts in their own field who say, no, the climate people arguing for the warming of the globe are wrong. What do they base their evidence on?
It can be a whole range of things. Part of it is thinking that the modeling, often it's the modeling that we do. We have these giant climate models that try to account for all the different effects. It's a very complicated system. And in many cases, they believe that those are just manifestly inadequate to the task. I think the evidence is that actually they do a pretty good job. Some people think, oh, there's certain things that we've left out, and they'll have their own little bit of what they think is important that's left out, and that will change everything. There's different ways of looking at the statistical analysis, and I think the consensus opinion is doing quite straightforward analysis that most of us agree on. But there are outliers there about how that analysis should be done. So it's a whole range of different things. It's not normally, 75 different things with an expert, because no one is expert in everything.
Now, some of the scientists who have been advocating climate change action and have been very strong on believing that the globe is warming have been pilloried in some cases. How do you account for this, and is this still going on?
Well, it's a contentious issue, and it makes people, very, very anxious, upset in many cases. And I think some people genuinely believe that somehow the scientific establishment is not just getting it wrong, that we're somehow corrupt. And I guess
why
that's...
Why would they think? This.
Mathematicians
are not accused of being corrupt.
I think it's because the stakes are so high. And, when people are looking at their plight, they see this as being something that is very different to what they're used to. And we all see the weather of the day, and that's a very different thing to a scientist than the weather of the climate. But to individuals, we see it as being, the observation we make. So I think it comes down to a sociological question about sort of denial, in the same way that some people, when they get an adverse health finding, go out and look for the doctor who will tell them they're not sick. And I think that's what's going on here in many cases.
Now, in terms of the average Australian, what does climate change mean? What will it mean in the next 1, 2, 3 decades?
So over the next 10 years, you can expect, mildly changing conditions. We can expect droughts to be a little more prevalent than we've used to. We can expect major rain events to be larger statistically than they used to be. We can expect that the temperature will rise probably on average by another 2, 3, 4 tenths of a degree, depending on exactly, of course, how we act. So let me just say, from the example, one of the things I do is I have a vineyard. Well, I have planted different varieties of grapes because I can see that the grape that I grow now, Pinot Noir, will no longer be suitable to camber. I'm going to need to have a different variety. So farmers who are used to farming in certain places with certain amount of water are going to have to change what they do. That would be probably the strongest place where we'll see change.
When will you need these new grapes by?
I don't really know. Yeah. The problem is that, you know, the science of climate is still, it's not just with wicked precision that we go. We have to go through, and we have this range of forecasts. And so I'm guessing I will want to change in the next 25 years or so.
But you're a cautious grape grower.
Absolutely. So I make a little bit, and when, you know, my new variety is better than the old variety, I'll switch over. That's sort of the plan.
Now, of course, the government was very upset when President Obama focused on the effect on the barrier reef of climate change. What do you think will happen to the barrier reef when, if adequate action isn't taken? And do you think that that presidential warning was, in fact, well judged?
That's a tough call. You know, I'm not an expert in the Great Barrier Reef. The evidence is that we're already having a huge effect on the Great Barrier Reef. And, you know, the effects of cyclones are historical, and that hasn't actually changed much. Probably one of the most critical changes is water quality. And that's something we've been doing for a long time, and we can probably fix pretty quickly and easily. And that seems to be one of the most important contributors. Then we have the longer term effects of coral bleaching and of ocean acidification. Now, bleaching seems to be becoming worse, and as the water temperature rises, the corals will be bleached more and more. It hasn't been a huge effect compared to the water quality by most estimates. The acidification has almost done nothing yet, but there becomes a tipping point as we get more and more CO2 into the atmosphere, where that could really doom large parts of the reef if we don't do anything. And so I think, you know, the Great Barrier Reef has some serious issues, and it is going to be one of the hardest things to save if we don't, even if we act quickly. It's really under peril already. And so do I think Obama's discussion was well judged? I think from the Great Barrier Reef's point of view, absolutely. Whether or not it was the right political thing to do to advance the conversation here in Australia, that's less clear.
Well, at least it highlighted it.
It sure did, but sometimes, as we know in political circles, and you know this far more than I do, sometimes we need to be subtle to advance political arguments, and sometimes we need to go in with a nuclear bomb, and you have to judge that case as a politician.
There's a lot of controversy around the government's direct action policy, and many commentators feel that it's not robust enough. What's your view?
So, again, this is more for an economist. So, direct action is one way in the short term to deal with climate change. I think most commentators would agree it has some issues about dealing with climate change in the long term on the 50-year time scale.
But too expensive or just not effective?
So I think the issue is that it's not nearly as effective or economically effective as a emissions trading scheme, for example. And so it seems to have limited capacity to, for example, knock down emissions by 90%, where you can imagine a cat and trade doing that. It might be very expensive. So I don't think it's my place to say if it's the right or the wrong policy now. It could be a transition strategy, but what I would like to see the various political parties talk about is the long-term solution. What are we going to do? How are we positioning ourselves long-term? And I don't think any of the major parties have actually talked about how their policies are doing that yet.
Now, in the context of the Paris conference this year, of course, everyone was very disappointed that the Copenhagen conference of a few years ago was more or less a fizzer. It did achieve some things, but not nearly as much as was hoped. Do you believe that Paris will come up with the goods?
This is a sphere of politics that I have very little insight into, I'm afraid. I'm always amazed and surprised about international politics. The fact that the UK has come out so strongly with across-the-board support, a big positive, that China U.S. accord before the G20, that's a positive outcome. So certainly things look in much better shape than before Copenhagen. Does that mean we're going to get across the board? I think we need to remain, I remain optimistic, but I think we're going to have to watch and see.
Just to end on a couple of questions more generally about science in Australia, do you see a rise in the politicization of science in this country?
I would say only a little bit. Most of the time, science remains, as I would normally describe, there seems to be supreme indifference to science in most aspects of policy here in Australia.
By the politicians or by the community generally?
I would say by both. And, you know, we just sort of take it for granted and everything will be fine. We don't have to pay much attention to it. That seems to be the action. I note that political parties in opposition seem to be much more supportive of science than when they're actually in power. And that works both directions, as near as I can tell. And so there is some politicization of science through things like climate change, the carbon, coal seam gas, carbon sequestration, these types of things. But most of the time, I think those have always been there. We just have a bit more ability to pick apart scientific arguments due to the internet by choosing, you know, judicious choosing of experts, which is how scientific arguments in the internet age are pulled apart. They used to be very difficult to get those people because they were kind of hard to find when they were in Uzbekistan or whatever, and now it's pretty easy to find them. And means that I think we need to think about how science engages with the media, because we need to be able to talk about the concerns, different points of view. But I think we need to come up with a way to get the consensus across. And indeed, that's what this document we're talking about here today is meant to do.
So do you think scientists should enter the political debate more often? Do you think they're too timid of doing so?
I think when we enter the political debate as individuals, we confuse things. So to be clear, in this case, I'm entering the political debate on the backing of a document by the Academy, which is a consensus document. If I were to disagree with this consensus document, it is not my role as an individual to get out and shout down the document. It is my role to go in to the science rooms and discuss with my fellow scientists what that document should be by my view. So I think it's important for us to be relatively ordered. Think of us as how a well-functioning political party works. Probably, you know, back chat doesn't work very well.
Well, it sounds like cabinet solidarity or something like that. Is that really a good idea if you're good scientists? Don't you go where the evidence takes you?
We absolutely need to take the evidence where the evidence takes us, and that means discussing in scientific fora where people can actually understand the evidence. I can sit down with your listeners and we can talk about Bayesian evidence, but I'm going to lose you in paragraph two when I really get to brass tacks. And unfortunately, if I have a problem with an individual thing of maybe a given analysis, that gets amplified as complete uncertainty for the entire field. So if we're not disciplined, it appears to me that society's method of dealing with the uncertainty is just to throw up their hands and run away, even though, you know, the uncertainty is really not there. It's a tiny amount of uncertainty. There's not a way for them to deal with it.
Brian Smith, thank you very much for talking with us today. Just tell us before we finish where people can find the document.
So the best place to go is on to the Academy's website, which is www.science.org.au, and there'll be a big headline leading you to the documentation there, which you can download.
That was Brian Schmidt. Thanks very much, and that's all from the Conversations Politics podcast for today. Thank you to my producer, Matt Dawson. Back with you soon. I'm Michelle Grattan.
I was saved by God to make America great again.
An autocrat loves a crisis. A crisis is the way that they mobilize their base.
While America is under invasion from within, we're under invasion from within.
He's testing the boundaries of what he can get away with.
We should use some of these dangerous cities as training grounds for our military, National Guard, but military.
We've asked six of the world's preeminent scholars how we can measure the make of an autocrat. It's a recipe of sorts, tried and tested by the most infamous leaders in history.
Hugo Chavez in Venezuela.
Vladimir Putin in Russia.
Joseph Stalin and Adolf Hitler.
Viktor Orban in Hungary.
He's basically bulletproof in terms of criminal prosecution.
Join us from December 29 as we explore Trump, the making of an autocrat, from The Conversation.